makeup, and live streaming from Kingston's own Bob Marley Festival. Again, that's the first annual Portland Bob Marley birthday party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom at 615 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of Religion for Life. I'm beginning a series called Islam 101, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor. I'll be talking with local Muslims in the Portland area, as well as Quranic scholars. This week, I speak with Ali Hadroj of the Islamic Center of Portland. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Eyes for Allah, nothing but Allah. Ba is the beginning of Bismillah. Ta is for taqwa, the wearing of
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the West Coast premiere of What Every Girl Should Know, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from February 4th through the 27th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. What Every Girl Should Know takes place in a Catholic reformatory in 1914 during Margaret Sanger's campaign for wider access to birth control and deals with the effects of denying women control over their own bodies. Due to the subject matter, those under 14 need to be accompanied by an adult. Again, that's What Every Girl Should Know, February 4th through the 27th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The music playing is Interstellar Dub by DJ Mad from Portland label Zam Zam Sounds. I'm Andre Middleton, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. I'll be hosting Art Focus on Tuesday mornings from 11:30 to noon on a bi-weekly basis, alternating with Mr. Joseph Gallivan. Thank you for joining us today. Today's Art Focus is obviously starting a half hour earlier at 11 a.m. so we can spend more time with a very, very special guest, Mr. James Luna. But first up, some local art news. From our past to our present, Latina Art Now Collective presents an exhibition of contemporary local artists who challenge the presumptions of what Latino art is and takes the audience to a new level of awareness. Join them for their opening reception on January 30th from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Collins Gallery on the top floor of the Multnomah County Central Library. The exhibition will be up from now through Sunday, February 28th. Today, there's a candidates forum for arts and culture at 4 to 5:30 at the Girding Theater at the Armory, which is at 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. This will be a great opportunity to hear directly from candidates for mayor and Portland City Council about their vision for our city and the role that the arts and culture can play in a more innovative, prosperous, and equitable society. It's free and open to the public. Please note the doors open at 3:30 and the forum will begin promptly at 4. Arts Equity Grant Opportunity is now open to nonprofit organizations that are based in Portland and or Multnomah County. Nonprofit organizations that are providing arts and culture programming and services for marginalized communities, including geographically underserved neighborhoods, communities of color, immigrants, refugees, persons with disabilities, LGBT communities, and other underrepresented populations are encouraged to submit proposals for artistic programs and projects occurring between July 1st, 2016 and June 30th, 2017. To begin the application process, please send a letter of interest via their online at racc.culturegrants.org by February 24th at 5 p.m. Applicants whose letter of interest best meet the objectives of this grant program will be invited to submit a full application in March. Last up, the Hillsborough Art and Culture Council is offering their Professional Development and Networking Series now through April. Their next workshop is a grants workshop on February 20th at the Walters Cultural Center at 527 East Main Street in Hillsborough, Oregon. Scholarships are available to Washington County residents. please contact the Hillsborough Art and Culture Council for more information. My guest today has a career that spans decades as well as mediums. James Luna of the Puya Kichim Lisueño tribe has been creating and holding space for himself and other indigenous people here in America and around the world. James explores issues of indigenous identity in a contemporary manner that challenges the explicit and the implied relationships between the descendants of the colonizers and the descendants of those that were colonized. In many of his works, James stands, or lies as the case may be, front and center of his work. As an integral part of his pieces, he is actively engaged in a conversation with all that see his work. I am honored by his presence, and my perceptions have been expanded by his perspective. I welcome James Luna to KBOO's Art Focus. Welcome to you, James. Hey, welcome to you, James. Glad to have you in KBOO's Art Focus here in Portland, Oregon. Check one, two. James? No, I can hear him in the background. So, let me start off by saying that James is actually going to be coming to Portland next week as part of almost a week-long celebration of his work. Let me give you some information about where you'll be able to see his work. James will be at several events around town. He's going to be, his exhibit, Performagraphic, is going to be at the Blackfish Gallery February 2nd through 27th. Then Wednesday, February 3rd at 11:30 a.m., he'll be at the performative lecture at Mount Hood Community College. Then on Thursday, February 4th, he'll from 6 to 9 p.m., he'll be at an artist reception at the Blackfish Gallery as part of their first Thursday. And then on Friday, February 5th at 5:30 p.m., he'll be doing a gallery talk at the Blackfish Gallery. And last but not least, next Tuesday, a week from today, on February 9th at 7 o'clock, he'll be doing an MFA studio lecture series at Portland State University. Hello, James. Are you still there? James? Here's what I'm going to do. We are going to actually hang up and call him again and maybe having that ringer ring one more time, because I did talk to him earlier today. So I know he's out there down in La Jolla, California. So I'm going to be with you just for a moment. And so while we try James's line one more time. Once again, thank you for joining us here on Art Focus. We've really been looking forward to this interview, and I know James has too. As you all know, Blackfish Gallery is a nonprofit gallery collective. They show art not only from across the region, but obviously from around the world. I have to admit, when I posted up that I was going to be interviewing Mr. Luna, my Facebook feed blew up. There were a lot of people, not only of indigenous populations, but people that I consider friends and allies, who were really excited about the opportunity of hearing some of what Mr. Luna had to ask, had to talk about. So I went one step further and I actually invited some friends from across the region to send me some questions. So some of the questions are not going to be coming from me directly, but they'll be coming from some of my friends. The next up is thinking about identity. You know, I have to say, as a person of color living here in Portland, Oregon, I'm often confronted not only about how I perceive myself, but how other those perceive me as well. And I think that's something Mr. Luna is going to be able to speak on in talking about, as an Indigenous American, how his art has to not only transcend his communicating with his own people and his own population, but how it has to interact with the perceptions of the colonizers, with the perceptions of white America. You know, all the awards that he's won, many of them have come from institutions outside of his community. And that's a bit of a dance that I think a lot of us have to entertain, or at least undertake, is that how do we not only celebrate ourselves and celebrate our community, but how do we do it in the context of how the majority sees us? What kind of space are they creating for us, or what kind of space are we creating for ourselves? That's one reason why I'm here today at KBOO Radio, because I'm looking to save space for myself and allies and my people. And I consider allies to be my people, to be perfectly honest. One way I've been doing that recently is I've been interviewing a majority of women who have been putting on, who have gotten grants and awards from the Precipice Award through the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. We've had some great interviews with women who are not only creating spaces in non-traditional art spaces, but are also creating space for women, creating space for femmes, creating space for LGBT communities, making sure that not only is there a place at the table, but that place becomes a permanent place. So right now, it looks like we're still trying to get a hold of Mr. Luna. Called him earlier, talked to him. He sounded pretty excited. He said he was in his car. Maybe he gets better reception in his car. And when we just got a hold of him a couple seconds ago, we could hear sounds in the background. I don't know if it was a car radio or just traffic going by. So I know it's not a technical difficulty, but hopefully he'll be available shortly. So it's funny, it's such a small world. I know one of the volunteer directors over at the Blackfish Gallery, a woman by the name of Mary Dawn Duckler, and she reached out to me a few weeks ago to see if I might be interested. And let me tell you, I really was interested in interviewing Mr. Luna. So what I think I'm going to do next is I think I'm going to actually turn to the Facebook and see if I can field some more questions from the masses that might have a question or two for Mr. Luna. So if you have any questions you might like to pose to Mr. Luna, please go visit our KBOO Art Focus page. That's KBOO Art Focus, and post a question or two. Right. So right now, I just got a note from one of our producers that we think James might have walked away from his phone. I said I was going to give him a call back in 5 or 10 minutes, and it's been about 5 or 10 minutes, so I'm going to expect that he should be back shortly. Right now, it is still connected, so we're going to keep trying to get a hold of him. But until that happens, I'm inviting people to log on to Facebook if you've got an electronic connection nearby. It could be your phone, could be your computer, and go visit the KBOO Art Focus page and, you know, pose a question. You know, I'd love to broaden this conversation beyond just myself and to see if there might be anybody out there who might have a question or two. So right now I've got a post up called our next episode will be live tomorrow, which is actually today. I've got a couple of photographs of Mr. Luna's work. And in the comments section below, please pose a question. I'm really, really looking forward to not only your questions, but hearing some of his answers. He's had a storied career, traveled the world, has been bringing his art and himself. That's an interesting thing about Mr. Luna is that he actively engages in his work. It's not just paintings on a wall or music through a speaker or I'm talking through a microphone. He is often integral, front and center in his work. And I plan on asking him about that in a minute or two. So here we are. Once again, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry for the delay, but hopefully my rambling and ranting will continue to keep you glued to that radio. This is Andre Middleton, and this is 90.7 KBOO in Portland, Oregon. Listener-supported KBOO. Thank you so much for those who are joining us today and who've actually contributed in the past. KBOO can't be KBOO without your help and assistance, and we thank everyone who either volunteers, donates, listens. It takes all three. So I can see them working furiously inside the studio, inside the control room, still trying to get hold of our guest, and I am going to look at some of the topics that we might end up talking about. One of Mr. Luna's works that I found quite incredible is a piece called the Artifact Piece. This was done back in 1997. And basically, it shows Mr. Luna lying in a display case, as it would be inside of a museum. And often, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware of, when you go to museums, we often see indigenous artifacts, bits and pieces of their daily lives. It could be pottery shards or full pieces of pottery. It could be totems, ceremonial or pieces of artwork that are put on display with so little context of how they were used on a daily basis. That's something that I've talked about with a variety of other artists here on Art Focus, is how for a lot of indigenous art, art was not made as a form of commerce per se, but it was made as a part of life. Whether it was jewelry, whether it was pottery, whether it was tools, they put a level of craftsmanship into those tools because these tools were integral to their survival. And it's interesting how nowadays a lot of artwork is created literally as a means of commerce. Now, that's not to suggest that a lot of artists don't make work because it is a tool of their craft. It is a tool of their expression. I'm not denying that. But I do believe that as the Western society, as the colonizers, it seeks to further import commerce and capitalism into every facet of our lives, it's interesting to see how so much of the context is taken out of that. So this piece I'm looking at now, which you can probably find online, if you look up James Luna and type in artifact piece, you can see this. It's basically a man in a loincloth lying in a display case. And there are several cards of identifying different bits and pieces around him, much like you'd find in any museum in today's world, where there's, like I said, so little context is applied to the work itself. So it looks like we are still working and endeavoring to get a hold of Mr. Luna. Mr. Luna is actually going to be in town coming up pretty soon. I want to say it's early next week. Not to see, but obviously he'll be here for the Blackfish Gallery exhibit. He's going to be in several spots around town. Like I mentioned, next on February 2nd, from 27th, he's going to have a show called Performer Graphic at the Blackfish Gallery here in the Pearl District. After that, he'll be on Wednesday, February 3rd at 11:30 a.m., a performative lecture at Mount Hood Community College. After that, on Thursday, February 4th, which is obviously first Thursday, he'll be at an artist reception at the Blackfish Gallery as part of First Thursday. On Friday, February 5th, at 5:30 p.m., he's going to be doing a gallery talk at the Blackfish. Once again, that's open to the general public. And then Thursday, February 9th, at 7 p.m., he's having an MFA studio lecture series with James Luna at Portland State University. Please reach out to all those organizations for more information about how you can attend if they are open to the public. When all is said and done, I want you to know that you'll be able to find links as well as guest info on our show page. That's HTTP. /kbu.fm Art Focus. Please follow the link to our Facebook page. All right, and we've got James Luna on the line. Good morning, sir. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you.
Outstanding, outstanding. Well, I started off by giving a little background, but I wanted to let you know that when I shared that I was going to be interviewing you, the response from my friends was quite profound. I had hoped to share this space with a good friend of mine, Natalie Ball, but her schedule didn't permit her participation. So I decided to hold this space for her and for some others. So there may be some questions that I'm going to share with you that were actually from other people. So
not a problem. No, I'm open to it all. Yeah.
Well,
see, that's what happens when you live long enough.
Exactly. So if you don't mind, can we start off? Can you give us my audience a little bit of your background and how you discovered your need to be an artist?
Well, I believe that. It comes to you after a few years. I don't think anybody wakes up and says, I'm going to be an artist. But certainly, through trial and error, you find something that you gravitate towards and something that you do that identifies you as an individual. That's something that you can do, whether it be sports or art or, math or something. And my mom never discouraged me. She was always encouraging me and nurture that difference, because it's a risk to be an artist in a way, in society.
Yes, it is.
You're different, so you have to get over that. And as of late, I'm going to be 66 very soon, and just things are happening in my life that I'm very great. Well, I've always been proud of, but just more aware of, And one of them is over the last few years realizing that being an artist is a gift. It's a spiritual gift. Or call it a curse, because it's just sort of like, your mind is always working. You see things that people don't normally see, or you see it in a different way, and then you come to terms with it, and then you realize you have the ability to make something from those thoughts and visions and things like that.
Right. My friend Natalie Ball from the Klamath Modoc tribe asked me to ask you, as a performance artist who uses their own body as a medium, and she said here in exclamation point, you have style, man, top to bottom. Can you tell us about how you developed your style and what were some of your influences?
Well, in the beginning, no. I was taught in the minimal art way and spoke to that with my installations, and then I hadn't really thought or that my performances in the as objects within the installations were performances per se, and then you know people said, well, no, it's just another form of you know. Performance, you don't have to say anything, you know, you're speaking, you know, you're speaking very loud in your quietness and your silence. And so then I got asked to do a show in Chicago. I remember this was like in 92, 91 maybe. And I accepted it. I said, oh, this is great, you know. And then I realized, I thought, well, you know, what the heck am I going to do? I've been pretty silent, you know, for whatever reason, I've not had a trouble to speak out, but to an audience, that's a whole different thing. So I'm sitting at the steps of this space just thinking, what am I doing here, you know? And then I said, well, you know, you're an object within this installation and just be that object that happens to speak. And over time, you know, you realize that, you know, you need to be heard. You need to be clear in what you're saying. And your gestures, you know, speak louder than words, you know, and then find your own voice, whereas such that maybe I had started using words in my presentations, you know, that weren't normally my words. So, you know, got over that, you know, started thinking about, you know, how would Indians, you know, speak to this or how do we speak to this, you know, and I started, you know, observing, and that's a big part of it. And particularly about how, you know, certain people in our cultures speak and use their hands and look at you and nod and moments of silence and pausing. I'm thinking, you know, I got a lot of that going. You know, maybe I should really think about that and enhance that. And sure, I'm concerned about my audience, but, you know, those moments of silence, those moments of cultural voice, that doesn't necessarily have anything with language. It has to do with cadence. You know, it makes people lean forward to listen to you.
Right.
And you know, just put it all together, and that's how I deliver my monologues.
I think it's fair to say that your art challenges audiences. I was lucky enough to look at several of your work when you shared with me, and I was struck in particular by Take a Picture with an Indian. I saw a different dynamic when people took their picture with you that were white versus people that were indigenous. And, you know, there's a saying amongst people that I hang out with that among people of color that we got to get woke, you know, and once we get woke, we got to stay woke. How has the awakening of a lot of people of color, indigenous people, altered that conversation that you're having with audiences?
People of color?
Yeah, and indigenous people. Now that more of us are woke, more of us are aware of the game, and we're more aware of the interaction, how has that altered your conversation over the years?
Not a whole lot, because there's so much work to be done, you know?
Yeah.
When they called a while ago, you know, I was in La La Land listening to news radio, about the election.
Right.
You know, and just listening to that for just a few minutes, you know, says everything about how much work is there to be done. So the material's out there, you know, and it's about, you know, what and how to deliver it. And now that we're in a new media world, which I'm trying to keep up with, you know, there's a whole another ball game going on out there. But, you know, I've been trained in a certain way, and was raised at a certain time, and I'm very skeptical, or actually afraid of technology in some ways. So old school kind of works better for me. And what I mean by that is rather than be, you know, technical and have all this, you know, flash and help, that, you know, the best route for me is using illusion, you know, and that could mean a lot of things, you know. How do you set up, you know, an illusion, you know, with less is more? You know, that's going back to the minimal concept. And, you know, going back to how our own people do things, you know, while I see a lot of up and coming, you know, young artists that are really good and, you know, they kind of start out with this space that I don't think, because it's media, they really know quite what they have and do it and it's successful, you know, and you know, then when they're challenged, then it becomes a little harder. I mean, everybody can make a movie, but not everybody can make a good movie.
Right.
So that's where I'm at with that, I guess.
My friend Zintakala was wondering, what were your thoughts on whiteness and how we as indigenous natives, Indians, embody whiteness today? Also, how whiteness has had an impact or constructed how our men form their identity?
Whoa. Well, well, you know, one of the things that I had mentioned a few years ago was try to get whiteness out of my vocabulary. Because for one, it kind of sets up, you know, a situation where people maybe not readily listen. So I changed my strategy and have been quoted as saying, let's talk about our similarities and then we can talk about our differences.
Right.
Okay, I believe, you know, and this just happened over the last few years too, that, you know, our culture is really in need of healing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of scars there that need to be, you know, worked on and not blame someone else, but, you know, do, you know, work on them ourselves, not laying blame and pointing fingers. And, you know, it's a very long, messy, complicated cycle of social destruction. You know, younger guys have a tude and they get that from the older guys. You know, where did they get it? You know, well, it's festering anger and how to respond to the world, which leads into all kinds of things, you know, substance abuse, you know, on the radio. And we're trying to break that cycle, but it's not an easy thing.
You did.
I just recently read a book called Bad Indians, and it's about a enrolled band of Indians in Northern California by Deborah Miranda. And she explained it so well, and I'm thinking, geez, you know, I've been thinking about this issue for so long, and through poetry, history, her own life story, she, you know, explained it, you know, through her father's pointless but pointed anger at the world and how that just, you know, just dominoes, you know, things. And so, you know, I guess that would be my answer to that, you know, because when I did half Indian, half Mexican, I didn't really do it for quite the white audience. I did for our audience. And the reason being is that I am half Indian and half Mexican.
Right.
And then you deal with the culture police within your community, you know, well, you're not Indian enough or, you know, and even if you're dark, you're different because you're kind of educated. Oh, you didn't grow up here. You know, it's just like you just can't do anything right. And the people that are pointing the fingers are equally, you know, why? You know, and I thought of that piece. It was just a spontaneous day of photography, and that piece came out, and I realized, you know, what I had done, you know, and it's one of my signature pieces. And over the years, it still holds strength, and that's because the issue itself has grown as far as identity. Maybe not as caustic, but it's still there, and it's a question within our community, you know, that, you know, we're still dealing with, and, you know, with down here in the South with our casinos and people being put off the rolls, and you know, just different thing dealing with blood degree, and you know, where do we go from here? You know, it's an issue alive and well, not just in what people think is the bigger society, but within our communities. And I'd like to think of myself as you know, a helper within my community, and that's why I've always gravitated to subjects, you know, that I feel need to be spoken for. I'm a trained therapist. I was a counselor for 23 years, an academic one, but nonetheless trained as a therapist. And the first thing in the road to recovery is to speak about it. You know?
Right. Speaking of counseling, and I know a big part of counseling is memories and identifying and embracing and purging potentially. But my friend Natalie wanted me to ask a question in particular. She says that she grew up knowing your work. Her dad kept a small catalog of your work, and that's where she first saw AA meeting and art history, End of the Trail, Half Indian, Half Mexican. Her dad had a special place for this catalog, and he would bring it out, sit me down on his lap, flip through it with me to make sure that I knew your work. She says, I think your work hit home for my dad, and it was art that he could relate to, down into his bones, so to speak. Now, reading artistic statement on your website, you say that many Indian artists forgot who they were by doing work that had nothing to do with their tribe, by doing work that did not tell about their existence in the world today, and doing work for others and not for themselves. I now understand what my dad was feeling and seeing, and I want to thank you for your continuous work. You gave me permission, in a sense, to pursue my art unapologetically. So she wants to know, what are your thoughts about contemporary Indian art today? You've been in the art game for a while. Do you have any advice for younger Indigenous artists?
Well, it's always gratifying to hear things like that. It's like one of the biggest compliments I got Indian way was someone said, hey, we got your picture on our refrigerator. You know, I thought, wow. You know, no big award could match that. And I've changed my tune a little bit on that, and I think you're allowed to as an artist, that there's plenty of room for all of us. You know, at the time, I think I probably made those kind of statements was, you know, I was, you know, really feeling good, really hot about the issues that I spoke to, and it opened up new ground for people to speak on them, and we're still not done. But, you know, as I look around, you know, times have changed, you know, since you know, I started 30, 40 years ago, and you know, there's new and exciting stuff. You know, there's post-commodity out there doing minimal sound, spacey, you know, statements dealing with multimedia things. You know, there's Jackson Two Bear and Tribe Called Red, and you know all this stuff going on, and you know it's great. So I'm not going to hold them or any of them to political statements. You know, it's about exploring art, and some of us will do that and continue to do that, and other ones will speak to, you know, the here and now. So it's a very exciting time for Native arts, not just in contemporary visual arts, but writing. You know, we're getting exposure. We're creating our own music, scenes and stuff. But, you know, again, there's a lot of work to be done. It's like, you know, we're still on the outside. You know,
yes.
When I started back in the 90s, I got in through the multicultural thing, and then I realized, well, I made it. I'm doing mainstream, you know, spaces. Well, yes and no. I was doing mainstream spaces as an ethnic artist, and I was the convenient Indian that everybody wanted.
Right.
And then, you know, it went on to, you know, the multicultural box to, you know, the contemporary Indian box, and, you know, this box and that box. But, you know, how many, you know, they're doing this big thing about Hollywood and black actors and actresses. Where are the Indians? You know, where are the Latinos? And you know, so there, you know, there, again, there's a lot of work to be done. And you know, I've dealt with those boxes and, you know, still dealing with them. But, you know, I'm very busy right now. So there must be someone that's interested. And I'm so happy to come to Portland because not only will I be exhibiting, but I get to talk about my work as well. And share things, you know, for people that are have these kind of questions. I welcome you to come. You know, that's what I'm there for, you know.
Thank you. That is a perfect transition.
To share with people work that they haven't seen.
So you have an exhibit coming up at the Blackfish Gallery starting February 2nd through 27th called Performagraphic. Can you give our listeners a little, I don't want to say preview because we want them to come see it, but can you give us a little background on your practice and process for putting together this particular piece?
Well, I mean, over the years, I realized, you know, like with half Indian, half Mexican, that's a bodywork, right? And but I use photographs to speak to it. It wasn't just documentation; it was done for the camera. So, what am I doing for the camera while I'm performing for it? And then I realized over the that I had more work that fell into that category where I was dealing with archival photos.
And right.
I mirror archival photos. I become ceremonial objects using my body and the less props that I can, classic poses, mimicking them. I looked at this body of work and, this in 2011, I got to premiere it under a different name, a selection of my works. But since that time, there's new works. They'll be shared with it in Portland. So, let's call it a kind of a recent survey, at least from the last 10 years. So again, it's like, a lot of work that people have not seen. Yeah.
Right. So another question, speaking of work that people may not have seen, Natalie questioned, I want to ask, she says, I have yet to experience your latest performative piece, Ishii. The archive performance. So she's been reading about it and trolling it on social media. It was written that Ishii, the archive performance, pays tribute to the man known during his lifetime as the last wild Indian. James Luna portrays Ishii, who died in 1916, as the last member of the Yahi Native American indigenous to Northern California. Through his performance, Luna and Sheila Tishla Skinner not only pay tribute to Ishii, but also give voice to indigenous women. Can you tell us a little bit more about your performance piece, Ishii, and how you came to collaborate with Sheila Tishla Skinner? And can you also tell us how this piece gives voice to indigenous women?
It's a process. And, for me, it goes back... My uncle would say from time immemorial that I had, seen that book on Ishii and looked at those photographs and just, wondered and pondered. And as I grew up politically and, artistically, I kept looking at those photos thinking, there's a story there. But, there's certain things that, that are just sort of special. And how do you do this? And there's been movies and documentaries and stuff. But,
right.
All through that and through these hundreds of photos and all this stuff and the movies as well, but I just don't think they spoke for him, And so I was working on a show dealing with icons.
Mm-hmm.
So in this photographic pieces, I become icon, I become O.J. Simpson.
Right.
O.J. Simpson's putting on his gloves and I'm putting on my Indian mittens, in suit and tie. And it's laughable and this and that. So, I have space for more photos and stuff. And the Ishii book happened to pop up someplace, and I'm looking at it. And then it came to me because there's...
Will you park? I can't get out.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll move. And some guy... I'm in a parking lot. He asked me to move. So I'm there looking at these photos, and then he started speaking to me. I mean, not literally, but there was a moment there when, I grouped these photos and there was something that was going on there beyond me, and that's the performance.
Right.
I group photos, put a title, and I respond to them, you know? And there are moments, you know, when it's basically, I think him more than me, but as an artist, you know, I'll fix him up, I'll add another little color. I mean, I'm an artist, that's what I do.
Right.
And then I had worked with this young artist, Sheila, Filipino-American here from San Diego, and we were working on some stuff, and she was in the video that's part of the performance.
Yes.
And then I realized she didn't have a voice in this, and hence, indigenous women didn't have a voice. And I'm thinking, you know, here, you have a scene, you know, speak to how you feel about this. Wow. And through a process and through a couple of shows, she's gotten this to a real high epitome, you know, where we just did this in Washington a week and a half ago, and it was on mourning. And it was on mourning for the people, you know, and at the end of the performance, you know, she cuts her hair, you know, 4 or 5 inches at her long hair. And it was a very beautiful moment, and I thought, you know, how majestic can you get? You know, how true and sacrificial and real can you get? You know, it was a beautiful moment. So pieces grow. You know, I'm going to do this piece in 2 weeks with Janine Friel, Julie, up in Canada, in Toronto.
Uh-huh.
She's my my collaborator in Canada. And she'll interpret it in a different way, in her way. So it's really quite beautiful to see, you know, these two different, you know, beautiful native women step up to the plate and take the story on in the way they would feel. And I'm feeling really great about it because it added a whole new dimension to my work that I hadn't really had there, you know, because I can't speak for women.
Right.
You
right.
know, and here they are. So I just feel like it's a great moment. And I feel this piece is probably the best piece I've done since the Artifact piece.
Well, that brings up a good point. I think there's a real movement in the art world right now, and maybe it's been there for a while, but maybe due to social media and electronics, we can see more of it from our, you know, our computer screens. But there's a real movement to take over spaces that have not been formally designated as art space, much less art space for people of color. Mm-hmm. How does your work reflect and maybe even represent this a bit?
Well, that's funny because I'm working kind of in reverse, because I can tell you that over the 30, 40 years that I've been working, I know I've performed in every kind of conceivable space. And I know sometimes maybe my over the last 10 years, I've elevated it to another level where I do need lighting. I do want lighting. I do want a soundboard. There's video projection.
Right.
And so, you know, the piece has to conform, the space has to conform to the piece, or we do the best we can. And then every so often you're handed a situation where, like, it really presses you. We just presented this ishi in the Lincoln Ballroom at the National Gallery. The big rotunda, and it was a little bright, but, you know, we made it work. I'm taking it to Wesley University in April, and we're going to be doing it at the cathedral. You know, so it's kind of like... you know, you meet the challenge. You know, I could have turned down that cathedral, but it was just too sweet. You know, what a challenge, what a space. I mean, the ambiance is already there. You know, this is a spiritual
right
happening here. You know, it's just not a skit. It's not just a performance. You know, I really feel like this story, you know, transcends so many things. And, you know, my other challenge in life, or, you know, quest is to have people hear these stories and let them resonate with them, but also become part of the curriculum.
Right.
That's where it's going to make some change, you know, because this story, you know, is still happening about being on the outside, being on the box, being looked at and assumed as, you know, before you even opened your mouth, you know. And that goes back to that whole thing we started in the beginning about whiteness and white privilege, you know. It's there, you know, it's there.
Right. So can you, tell us a little more. How did you come to be in Washington, D.C. about a week and a half ago? Was that just for Ishii, or was it part of a larger event?
No, it was for Ishii, you know, because, you know, things happen. You know, people ask me, younger artists, well, how do you, you know, get gigs, you know?
Right.
Well, you know, well, I've been it long enough. I have connections, but I did, when I first started doing Ishii, in fact, I premiered it at probably the best place I could premiere it was at the National Association of Museums, Archives, and Libraries.
Oh, wow.
Indigenous Archives, Libraries, and that. Yeah, and so, you know, it was in its infancy, and there was something needing it, and a friend of mine invited me to perform at his own performance festival in Boston, at the Boston Art Museum, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take this, because I need to develop it, and I'm going to take this and see what an East Coast crowd, how East Coast crowd will respond, so I took it, and I did it gratis. We went. And I performed, and I felt really great, and some woman comes up to me, hands me a card, and says, I'm from the National Gallery. We have to have this. Here's my card. Call me.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Sometimes it's that easy, man.
Right, right, right. No, there's definite flow. So I have another question from my friend Natalie. She says, you've collaborated with Guillermo Gomez-Pena in the past, for example, mm-hmm. a Nostalgia Remix. Can you tell us a little bit about your history, about how the two of you met and how you ended up working together?
That's a good one. I met Guillermo through the Border Arts Workshop in San Diego. It was a group of political artists dealing with, you know, artwork, presenting artwork as a group collaboration in San Diego, and he was part of it. And I had been asked to do a show there. They wanted a contemporary Native voice somehow involved with the Centro Cultural de la Raza mm-hmm. in San Diego. And, you know, through my association with them, which is part of the Borders Workshop, I met Guillermo. And, you know, I'm kind of, you know, like, this guy is... This guy's different. He's just giving off this, like, really flamboyant, strong, romantic, Spanish, accented, you know, aura, you know. And we befriended, and, you know, I am different, you know. I'm a little more subdued, quieter. But he's one of the few artists that came when I did the artifact piece in Balboa Park, there where the center was located.
Right.
And he was amazed. He was dumbfounded, and actually, you know, over the years we've borrowed pieces. So he did later a piece called Indians in a Cage that toured Europe, and it was different, but the theme was the same about, you know, Native people on display.
Right.
And then he said, hey, Luna, you know, let's get together and collaborate, you know. So over the years, you know, every few years we do something, and I think it was over the last 5 years we were more on a roll with a show that traveled, and I just recently performed in the same stage with him, and, you know, during the evening celebration, he said, let's do some work, and I said, yeah, but only if it's new.
Right.
So, you know, we'll probably get together, maybe even during this tour that I'm on right now. We're supposed to stop off in San Francisco and... meet with him and talk to him about, you know, some ideas that we had. And, you know, right now I'm not, it's not that I'm not interested, but I'm more excited about, you know, moving forward with new works.
Of course.
And new collaborations and, you know, working with younger artists. So, and going to places that I haven't been, you know.
It's interesting when you talk about that level of collaboration and, you know, the length of time that a relationship can be established and grow. It makes me think about cross-country conversations between artists and their collaborators, or even between artists that where they don't get to collaborate, yet they are bouncing ideas and concepts and themes and theories off of each other, and how different people's work can provide context for our own work. Can you think mm-hmm. of anyone that you can look back and say, you know, even though we maybe have never worked together, we've been engaged in this conversation?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know about anybody that I've never worked with. I meant, just right off the bat, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's plenty out there, but.
What about that dynamic? Yeah, what about that dynamic?
Well, that's on that same stage that night, about a month, 2 months ago in Santa Fe, Rebecca Belmore was there, and she's my hero. She's my performance art hero, hands down. I mean, if there's any work that I look at, don't even try to gravitate to, but try to understand and fathom the decision-making in it and how good it is, it's her. And we go back to 87. She got a grant. She's Cree from Canada, Thunder Bay, and was getting some exposure up there and got a grant to travel to meet, American Indian artists. So she came down and I met her at the train station and it was just like floored. She had that. She had it. And over the years, we've met, we've worked at different places. We were in Venice Biennale together.
Right.
And so just recently, the Institute of American Indian Arts, we presented together and it was the same thing. She just floored me. She just floored me like there was no tomorrow. She used a pedal string guitar. Someone played while she did a monologue on big screen video. And she made that, transformed that big 500 seat theater to hers and made it so intimate. You could hear a pin drop and just held us all spellbound in our seats for, the moments that she spoke. And I thought, damn you, so it's good to have heroes and it's good to have long lasting relationships like that and see them grow over the years and, about new ones and stuff. Well, I am meeting new people, and that's good. That's great. There's work out there I've seen that I'm really, challenged by and admire, but it's about more than art. It's about music and stuff too, It's about, I don't know, about movies so much.
Right, that was something. I guess something I did want to touch on was just the amount of the mediums that you have lived in, have breathed into, whether it is sculpture, mixed media, performance, yourself being the medium, and not to mention music. Considering your background with your counseling, I mean, it is such a broad scope. How do you keep it all woven together?
Well, it all begins with listening, which goes back into that thing about observing and what you see. But listening is a big part of it, and that's a big part of counseling. That's the biggest part. It's not about speaking and giving advice. It's about listening. And I was also trained as an elementary or a high school teacher, and that's speaking. Of course, there's listening, but it's speaking. Right. And so that's the place to start out with, after you get your initial ideas. And I don't speak or use mediums that I don't feel comfortable with or don't particularly think that I really need.
Right.
How do I, compensate for this? Well, get a big screen and, project on it from the rear. Wow, that's my stage, Let's talk about lighting, Let's talk about making me look pretty. Let's talk about shadows. It just starts kind of like, adding. But then if it gets to be too much, and this has happened in my career a few times, it's like, okay, back off. You're not this, you're not that. It's not a theater production, Okay, all right. Minimalize it. Know where your best work stands and, where it's strongest and what you really need and what you don't. There was a few years ago, video everything, kind of toning off a little bit. I enjoy a good painting. I love a good painting, and so that's, it's what I like, and what's painting have to do with performance? Everything, because that's where I started out in composition is now staging and color.
Right.
Is now lighting and, there's some similarities, but, there's some basic foundations, and that's the word, foundations.
Right.
Always remember those foundations, and never just let them resonate with you and remember them.
Right. Well, if you don't mind, we're going to be wrapping up a little bit, but this is the question I pretty much ask all my guests.
Sure.
What is the question that your art in a whole seeks to answer?
It's about what people think they know.
Hmm.
And to dispel those. That if they were to come to a performance or an exhibition by James Luna, that they would walk away and question and rethink about some, you know, concepts they had about people of color, about ethnicity, and maybe think, you know, I prejudged, you know, I assumed, you know, that's what I want. I kind of, you know, thought, well, can you really change someone's mind? No. Can you, you know, but can you get them to kind of just at least reconsider? And I thought, yeah, I can do that.
Right. Well, sir, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find your work? I know you'll be here next week, and I'm going to give people some dates and times of when you'll be here and where they can see your work.
I try to post things on Facebook, and I'm working on a new website that'll have a calendar, but this is kind of on a roll here right now. I'm going to be, you know, there in Portland, you know, at the Portland State University,
yep.
Mount Hood Community College at the gallery there. And then on the 12th, I give a lecture at the University of San Francisco and then leave for a show that opens on the 13th in the Woodland Art Center, which is near the Six Nations Reservation. And then on the 16th, perform at the Native Theater Space in Toronto. So I'm on a roll, but I'm trying to be better about listing things on the calendar, and, you know, things are popping up, and I guess that's my best source right now.
Great.
Until I get caught up in media.
Well, KBOO audience, this has been Art Focus with Mr. James Luna. His exhibit, Performographic, will be at the Blackfish Gallery from February 2nd through 27th. Then on Wednesday, February 3rd, he's going to have a performative lecture, as he said, at Mount Hood Community College. On Thursday, February 4th, which is also first Thursday from 6 to 9, he'll be at an artist reception at the Blackfish Gallery. On Friday, February 5th at 5:30, he's going to be doing a gallery talk. At also the Blackfish Gallery. And then Tuesday, February 9th, the week from today at 7 o'clock, in the evening, he'll be participating in the MFA Studio Lecture Series at Portland State University. Mr. Luna, thank you so much for joining us today. I wish you nothing but blessings and best of luck. And I actually look forward to meeting you next week when you're in town.
Yes, sir. And thanks for the questions from friends and fans there.
It was my pleasure.
Okay. Adios.
Adios. Well, folks, you can find links and photos as well as most of the guest information on our show page at KBOO.FM/ArtFocus. Please follow the link to our Facebook page and like KBOO Art Focus. Don't forget, From Our Past to Our Present, Latino Art Now Collective presents an exhibition by contemporary local artists that challenge presumption of what Latino art is, and take the audience to a new level of awareness. Join them for their opening reception on January 30th from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Collins Gallery in the top floor of the Multnomah County Central Library. The exhibition will be up through Sunday, February 28th. This afternoon from 4 to 5:30, there's a Candidates Forum for the Arts and Culture today at the Girding Theater at the Armory. It's at 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. This would be a great opportunity to hear directly from some candidates from mayor and the Portland City Council about their vision for our city and the roles that the arts and culture can play in a more innovative and prosperous and equitable society. It's free, open to the public. Please note, doors open at 3:30 sharp, and the forum will begin promptly at 4 o'clock. Last bit of news, couple things. We've got the Hillsborough Arts and Culture Council is offering their professional development workshops and networking series now through April. The next workshop is a grants workshop on February 10th at the Walters Cultural Center at 527 East Main Street in Hillsborough, Oregon. Scholarships are available to Washington County residents. Last but not least, the Arts Equity Grant now is open for nonprofit organizations that are based in Portland and or Multnomah County. Please visit rack.culturegrants.org and turn in your letter of interest by February 24th by 5 o'clock. Applicants whose letter of interest best meet objectives of the grant program will be invited to submit a full application in March. If you missed any part of today's show, there will be a podcast of this show online later today. Once again, it's my goal to introduce the listeners of KBOO to a broad spectrum of regional and obviously international artists. If you're a visual artist in any medium, I'd love to have you on our organization on the show. It's also my goal to share information relevant to artists as well. When I learn about residencies, grant deadlines, call for artists, you hear about it on this show, as well as find it on our Facebook page, KBOO Art Focus. We're going out to the music of Danny Skrilla from Portland's own Zam Zam Sounds. Thanks again for joining us on Art Focus here on KBOO Radio Portland, Oregon. Take care and peace.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill two vacancies on the Board of Directors. The Board will elect the new directors at the February Board meeting. Are you interested in nonprofit governance and in helping to shape the future of your community radio station? Do you have 10 to 15 hours per month to